Eurovision Song Contest takes place tonight in Vienna, Austria. The celebration of pop music is now in its 70th year. Organizers say it's the world's biggest music show. The more people watch, then they watch the Super Bowl. Viewers can vote on the 25 finalist songs by phone, text message, or online. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Kirk Marski from the German-American Heritage Center in Davenport. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. It's always hard to get the kids off the dance floor when they hear that hip tune. Yeah. So, but we've cleared them out, and it's just you and me now, Kirk. And Kirk, thank you very much for taking some time. I know this is a busy weekend for you.
It is.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you're here, and I want to get caught up because I've known you for quite a long while.
Yeah.
I mean, you did some stuff for WVIK when you were a student, didn't you?
Yeah, it was right after I graduated.
So okay.
I did a lot on WAUG, the student station. I did that for 3 years. And then the summer after I graduated, I was working a couple of different part-time jobs, and this was one of them. So I was happy. Herb Trix was my boss. So I had a good experience working with him, and a lot of my early career was radio. About half of my career has been in radio broadcasting. So it started with an internship and working with WAUG and the whole thing. So
as far as bosses go, you can do a lot worse than Herb Trix.
Right. That's right. That's right.
But you had some stints on some very popular programs on commercial radio in town. You mind giving us a little bit of a roster or a taste of that?
Yeah, I can tell you about that. Sometimes it seems like ages ago that I did it, and sometimes it seems like just yesterday. But I started at 97X was the station I was at as an intern, and it turned into a part-time position, then a brief position in the office where I was doing the work that I did as an intern. And that was the internship, really, was what was my key to everything that happened in my career after that, radio and otherwise. But I went to work at a rock station across town at Q106 with Dwyer Michaels. I worked with them for 11 years. Mark and Steve on Cool FM, which was the old E station. Did a little bit of a stint on WOC before I moved on to some other things. Worked for Junior Achievement for 6 years. And then kind of by accident found my way back to radio. I was looking to move on to another position and contacted my former boss at WOC and asked him for a reference. And he said he would be a reference, but he, by the way, was hiring for his position. He was getting ready to retire. So I ended up working in radio for another 2 years or so. COVID happened and I was laid off from there, but I went back briefly, but haven't been back since. So I've done a number of other jobs since then, and it's been a good journey. So,
well, it has been, and there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, before we get into the current state of radio in a market like this one, what I find is amazing is Dwyer and Michaels are still going at it. Isn't that cool? I mean, that's a real treasure to have. And I'm going to get in trouble. They're back at the X, aren't they?
Yes.
That's what I
they've
thought.
They've been back there since around 2006 or 7, somewhere in there.
So I'm at the stage where I never have control of my radio. Other people take control of my radio dial unless it's WVIK.
Right. There you go.
That's what I kind of lock it in as. But for people who aren't familiar, I mean, there's been this drastic change in radio.
Yes.
And I remember 20, 30 years ago, there was that beautiful building that WOC and its associated stations built up by the Palmer Golf Course, and you, I think, what, five or six stations were in there, AM and FM?
Yes, yeah.
And you could walk up and down. Dan Kennedy asked me to help out for a little while with just a weekend board shift.
Mm-hmm.
And you could walk up and down those halls, and I think it was six stations, maybe more.
Yeah, six or seven. And people ask me sometimes, do you miss radio? And I say, I miss the old radio because it was different. And what you're describing is I came into radio and my whole pathway to getting a full-time job was pretty typical. You start with an internship, you get part-time, you move your way up. But around the time that I was starting in radio was also the time where voice tracking and automation started to become a thing. So the building that you're describing had six or seven stations in it, different formats. It was part of the movement at that time. The FCC had changed their laws, and so you could consolidate more stations. And that whole building was full of people, and WOC in particular. You know, they had the farm reporter, and they had the news reporters, and the whole business. And
Max Molliston.
We had a full staff, yeah. And so over the years, as I stayed in radio, you know, eventually the evening position was eliminated and the overnight position because they could have somebody record it. And so over the years, the industry got to be a tougher industry to be in because there just were fewer and fewer opportunities to be in it. And the people that I know that are still in it, you know, congratulations to them. It's not an easy place to be. And a lot of them are recording shows and have responsibilities for a lot of other stations too. So it's not an easy business to be in, but those that are still in it, that's great. But for the rest of us, we find another way to move on and use our skills in different ways. So it was a great experience. I was glad I did it for all those years. And but being able to do some other things has been great too. So,
well, you mentioned there were some things about your internship that were seminal to the rest of your career. Would you mind expanding on that? I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, and I'll start with a little bit of a funny story, if you don't mind. There was so I had an opportunity to follow in the pathway of another student who was a year ahead of me, and he went to New York. He had an internship with NBC. So he worked in the sports department. And I thought, well, that sounds like a fun gig. Who wouldn't want to spend the summer in New York? So the internship director and I flew out to New York, and I went into Rockefeller Center and interviewed, and they gave me a quiz on how much I knew about sports. And that's when I realized I don't know a lot about sports and I should have applied for the David Letterman gig. And so, needless to say, I didn't get that internship, but, I came back home and there was another student, Scott Beatty, who had done an internship at 97X. And, so I kind of followed in his footsteps, and, my internship director, I give her a lot of credit. Monica Osdell's her name, because my position as the intern was kind of a clerical office job. But she let me go and learn different parts of the radio station. That's where I made all the connections, and that's where I learned what everybody wants to be on the air and radio. That's what you want to do. So I got that exposure, and I could fill in from time to time, and so that whole experience was really what led to everything else, like I said. So I didn't get there the first time, but it worked out. Great the way that it did, that I did the internship there. So
I got to share a Scott Beatty story that kind of ties some of this stuff together. But Scott was an amazing person. He's no longer with us. Phenomenal guy. And it was great at radio. If he were still around, he'd be one of those people that would still be standing in the radio. But before he did the gig at 97X, somebody, I think the Quad City Thunder was around in these days, the basketball franchise, and they had radio night, right? And it was so funny when these promoters would remember that there was a public station, you know, that about 500 people listened to, right? But they included WVIK. So they said, come out. Yeah. And what it was like at halftime, it was a three-point shooting contest or just as many baskets as you could make, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Scott was a very large guy. Mm-hmm. And if you just looked at him, he was not terribly athletic. He was rather large. But the dude could nail him.
Is that right?
From the perimeter. But the best part was Dwyer and Michaels. And I got to tell you, I want you to know, I am a huge fan of those guys.
Okay.
They've done so much for the community, right. And they are Quad Cities. I love those guys. Well, this was in the heyday of their 97X glory years. Mm-hmm. So at this event, early 90s, late 80s, somewhere in there. I forget when Scott was actually a student at VIK. So Scott's dressed like a suit. He's just got jeans, you know, whatever. And I'm just wearing probably some khakis and a blue Oxford cloth. And, you know, well, here come Dwyer and Michaels. And if I remember correctly, one of them's got ripped jeans and a half sort of tiger print T-shirt.
Sounds right, yeah.
And the other one is wearing leopard print leather pants, right? And their hair is immaculate, baby. I mean, they went through about three cans of hairspray because this is the big, big hair day, right? And I just remember one of them like, wait a minute, we're up against those public radio freaks? Oh, and that's almost a direct quote, the public radio freaks. So I looked at Scott and I said, you ready? And Scott heard it too. She says, oh yeah, we buried them. And I didn't make a single basket. I went under the hoop and I just dished it back out to Scott.
Oh, there you go.
And the guy was, he was murderous from the 3-point line. And so anyway, that's my story of good old Scott Bain.
Yeah, he was great. For
memory.
People that don't know, he was Scott Steele on the radio.
Oh, that's
so,
right.
You know, people may know him from that name.
But, and I think you had a name.
When your name is Kirk, you're always called Captain Kirk, through your whole life. So it's part of my the reason I don't like Star Wars. Star Trek.
You just got in trouble.
I like Star Wars.
You just got in trouble with all kinds fans.
Well,
that's all right.
The ones that are named Kirk that they can associate with what I'm saying, right?
Well, so, but
sympathize with me.
That's an epic, great character, right?
Yeah,
he was actually derived from another great character from literature, Horatio Hornblower.
Oh, yeah.
Gene Roddenberry based Kirk on an old character from 1930s novels.
Yeah.
He's phenomenal. All right. I don't want to get that far off. Where did you grow up?
Well, we lived in Moline through fifth grade. I went to Logan School.
All right.
And then we moved to Port Byron, Illinois. Mm-hmm. So I went to junior high and high school out at Riverdale. So that was where my formative years were in Port Byron. And then I went to Augustana for 4 years and moved back to Moline. So I've lived in Moline ever since. So.
All right. I'm going to put you on the spot. If somebody's making their first trip to Port Byron,
yes.
What do you tell people? What do you got to do? What do you got to do when you go to Port Byron?
Oh, well, see, the town has changed a bit since
yes,
I've lived there. But Riverbend Pizza is still there.
That's right.
I would recommend that. They have a lot of great restaurants and nightlife in Port Byron. Tugfest, of course, is something that you have to do. So those are probably the two main things. Where Riverbend Pizza is now, that was a restaurant that I worked in high school. It was called the Old Lighthouse.
And
I was an omelet chef, so I would flip the omelets on Sunday mornings and had a good time. It was originally we were at the Ranch restaurant, which is just on the edge of Port Byron. But they closed up shop, not because of anything that I did, but I managed the whole buffet. It was a country bar and restaurant. They'd have live country music on Friday and Saturday. They have this big buffet, and my job was to keep that stocked, and then Sunday was the Sunday buffet. So that also was an important part of my whole career, too. You know, those jobs you get when you're in high school, and they teach you all the important skills you need to know for later. So.
Well, there's something about growing up in a river town.
Yeah.
Right? Because it can be small and sleepy, but you're constantly welcoming people from someplace else.
Right.
And even in Port Byron, you know, if it's not river traffic, it would be motorcycles hitting 84 in the Great River Road, right?
Right.
Anyway, I was curious about where you had grown up. And,
yeah.
You've managed to make a wonderful career here in the Quad Cities. And we've been talking our way around it, but we got to eventually get to your gig now.
Yeah.
How did you land this gig at the German-American Heritage Center?
When I was done with radio and I was unemployed for a few months, I ended up working. It was during COVID, so the job market was not great. So I applied for probably 80 jobs in 7 months or so. Some of that was somewhat familiar to me. Some of it was a new experience, but I just saw it as a new journey. And I ended up working for 2 months in the Performance Food Service warehouse, actually, which is a great company. It was actually a great job, and I would have stayed longer, except the shifts were too long because they were short-staffed, and it was summer. So we were actually working like 12 to 14-hour shifts on average. Some of them were 16 hours, and it was I was too old to be doing that work, but it was a great experience. And I ended up going to Black Hawk College for about a year and a half, and then I worked for Renew Moline. So I managed the Moline Center program. I did that for 2.5 years, but I was looking for something to do different, and I knew that they were looking for an executive director. I do have some German heritage on my dad's side of the family, but I like history, I like architecture, I love the organization, and just saw it as an opportunity to to lead an organization and support an organization that's been around for 35 years and help be a caretaker for a building that's been around for 160 years. So
We'll get to that in just a minute. But just out of curiosity, what was your undergrad major?
It was communications, and then I had a minor in journalism and art history.
You could just about go anywhere with that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
good stuff.
It's worked out. It's a lot of what I've done over the years, even when I was in radio, basically is marketing. So I don't have a marketing degree, and I sometimes don't feel like I fit the mold of typical job positions. But it's more about leveraging the skills that you have and just seeing how you match up with that. So it's worked out well.
Well, and in just about any part of the not-for-profit universe, it's about relationships. Do you know how to cultivate relationships?
That's right.
And leverage those, and you've been very good at that for a long time. For someone who has never heard of the German-American Heritage Center, how do you define it? How do you describe it?
Well, I talk about it starting with the history of the building because it is a national historic site. And so the timeline for the messaging for me starts in the 1860s when the building was first built. It actually was built in three phases. If you look at the front of the building, it's four stories now, but the westernmost part of the building, the first three floors were the original part of the building. Shortly after that, they added the other two-thirds of the first three floors to make it what it looks like today. But then they added the fourth floor, so they just raised the roof up and put the fourth floor in there. And that was called Miller Hall, and it was a recreation area for the hotel. But so the building as you see it now has looked primarily the same since the early 1870s. But it was owned by John F. Miller. He was a German immigrant. And it was an immigrant hotel, or a German Gasthaus. And so passenger rail had come to Davenport in the 1850s. And the only place on the Mississippi River where it crossed the Mississippi River for passengers was Davenport, from Rock Island to Davenport. And so a lot of immigrants came to America, and they would either come up the river on the steamships or they would come from the east on passenger rail, and they would find their way to Davenport. And that hotel served as a temporary place for them to live. And a lot of Davenport's early history, the downtown area in particular, is German-based because so many stayed here. A lot of that had to do with the climate, and the industry was very similar to Germany. And so that's the history of the building. It became the Standard Hotel in later years. Part of that was because there was a Standard gas station right next to it, and so that made sense. And whatever marketing person came up with that, that was brilliant. But a lot of people know it by the Standard Hotel because when it went into foreclosure and was in disrepair in the 90s, that's what it was called. And if you see pictures of it from the 90s, you would not believe what kind of condition that building was in. But there were a group of people that were from different German organizations here in the Quad Cities that banded together to save the building. They raised $1.3 million and started investing in the building. So it first started with the first and second floor, then eventually they did the third and fourth floor. But so the timeline for that is the organization, or what we know as the German American Heritage Center, started in the mid-90s, 1994. So,
well, I do remember the Standard Motel very well, or hotel. I don't know which one it went by. But and if you grew up in the Quad Cities, that was not a place you'd think that you'd want to spend a whole lot of time in.
No, it isn't. Know,
coming over the Centennial in the 70s, early 80s, you would probably overlook it and just keep on driving.
Yeah, but it's at the gateway to the city right now.
So it is a gem.
Much better shape. So
it really is. And the setting we'll get to in just a minute. But there was a ready community for that kind of a Gasthaus immigrant hotel. It's interesting to study the patterns of German migration to the United States. You have some of the colonial stuff early on, but what I find fascinating is whenever there was a wave of unrest, usually in Central Europe, in the old Habsburg Empire, it would start displacing people like dominoes. And there are famous stories about how Johannes Brahms was playing piano in Hamburg in the 1830s. There were revolutions going on in, you know, Bohemia and other places. And all these immigrants would come through, and he was absorbing their music, right?
Oh, yeah.
Until they could take a steamer from Hamburg and then head over here. Another big one was 1848.
Yes.
And so I imagine there's a huge wave that comes in here. There's a kind of a sister city tie, though, with the very northern provinces of Germany, Schleswig-Holstein.
Yes.
Was there an immigrant basis for that, or is it just a target of opportunity?
Well, the piece of property that's east of us, there's a, well, the Lady Germania statue was there up until the 1917 or so when World War I started, and there was the anti-German sentiment. Mm-hmm. There was the fountain with the statue on it. In 2006, they put a recreation of that top of that statue in there. But that park and that area, there's a tribute to the 1848ers, as they called them, and mm-hmm. that's that group of people. The immigration that you're describing actually predated the passenger rail and the hotel itself.
So, right, right.
Yeah.
And that sort of opened it up. You mentioned the anti-German sentiment. I mean, it's fascinating where that goes, too. I mean, there were... Swedes are not Germans, but the Swedish Lutheran congregations, if you follow their histories, they gave up Swedish in about 1917, 18 because they didn't want to be associated. They want to be identifying. And so you couldn't have sauerkraut. You had Liberty cabbage. No, right? Just like later, I don't know if you remember, but during, what was it? Something in one of the Iraq conflicts, somebody got mad at the French, so they called them freedom fries something like that in the Capitol building.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were the people who would later, I guess, come to power. But anyway, so you have these little spasms of anti-immigrant, but you can't tell the story of the Quad Cities without talking about German migration here.
And really what we do is we talk about, we have our museum and our gift shop and our, you know, where we do our programs on the fourth floor, which we rent out for events too. But we tell the immigrant story and the experience, and our mission is to talk about the German immigrant experience as it relates to its impact on American culture. And so we talk about immigration in more of a historical context, but people draw their own conclusions based on things that are happening now as it relates to things that were happening then. So there's parallels. We do some programming on more modern immigration topics, I guess you would say, but for the most part, it's historical, but things are cyclical, and that's the reality of life. So it's things go full circle, and you can still see what's happening today as it relates to then. So,
and one of the things I've always been very impressed about with the German American Heritage Center is it doesn't flinch or shy away from issues related to the Holocaust. And we just had this Violins of Hope, Iowa, that was amazing to have instruments that were either owned by or played by Jews before and during the Holocaust. And the German American Heritage Center was front and center right in there.
Yeah, we owe a lot to the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities for that whole project and bringing that to Iowa as a residency. So we had 11 of those instruments on display for about 2 months. The Figge had some, and the Putnam Museum. And so there was some work with the symphony, and also Ballet Quad Cities was part of that. There was a whole other list of partners that were all involved with this whole project. But it was really led by the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities that made that possible. But yeah, we were happy to have that. And for me, that was the first time I got to see an exhibit get switched out in our building since I've been there. I just started in September, and Claire Tobin, who's our, she's our assistant director, but also our curator, she's the one that switched that out. And so for me, it was, besides the remarkable exhibit that it was on its own, to be able to see that get switched out and a new exhibit go in place was exciting.
And we're going to hear about that in just a moment and other things that are coming up. But right now, we just want to make sure that everybody knows it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to The Conversation on WVIK, a chat with Kirk Marski from the German American Heritage Center. Stick around.
Support for WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org. And support for WVIK comes from Aunt Rhody's Landscaping and Design Studio in Eldridge. Designing and installing landscapes to include patios, fire pits, ponds, outdoor lighting, and more. A full scope of services and scheduling consults is available at AuntRhodes.com. And support for WVIK also comes from Golder Care Solutions, offering advice about preserving assets, planning for the nursing home, and navigating Medicaid. Golder Care Solutions has been serving the Quad Cities since 2008. More information is at goldercare.com.
I'm Dee Canfield from Moline, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK, and this week a chat with Kirk Marski from the German-American Heritage Center in Davenport, and we're just talking about some of the great special exhibitions that you do, what's in prospect? Give us some previews of what's there and what's ahead.
Yeah, so the one that will start on this coming Tuesday in the space where Violins of Hope was is our first floor gallery, but it's called Shaped by Immigrants, the celebration of 250 years of the United States. So I have yet to see the whole exhibit. I know part of it was involving Turner's, which is... if people don't know, that's a German organization as well. So Claire put that together. She was still working on it. So that will premiere on Tuesday. We also have a Play On exhibit, which is on the third floor where our permanent exhibit is. And that was related originally kind of to the Violins of Hope. But it's focused on German musicians in the Quad Cities and the history, including the Quad City Symphony Orchestra.
Absolutely.
And how they came to be. So we're excited for that, and Bix Beiderbecke, also part of that. He was born in Davenport, but his family is from Germany. Mm-hmm, so, and then we have our permanent exhibit on the third floor as well. That's our immigrant experience, the German immigrant experience, 1845 to 1925. So, and we do, even though it's a permanent exhibit, we do update parts of it from time to time. So we had a ribbon cutting in August. I say we, that was right before I started.
Okay,
but I was at the ribbon cutting. But so part of that exhibit was updated, and there was another part that we did, I think it was in January, it was updated in partnership with the Silos and Smokestack National Historic organization in Iowa. So that's on the third floor.
Well, we got a lot to unpack right there. Mm. So you mentioned the Turners. So in German, Turnen is gymnastics. So a Turnverein was a gymnastics club, and you'll find a Turner's Hall all over the Upper Midwest.
Yeah.
There's, I think, a couple in Chicago, St. Louis, and different neighborhoods had their own in the bigger cities, but there still is a standing Turnverein. I think it's going through a big remodel right now in the Village of East Davenport.
Right.
But that was an amazing space.
And
because part of the German immigrant brand was physical fitness, physical activity, and outdoorism. So that kind of separated from some of the traditional English, you know, it was always cloudy there, so they just stayed inside. And the Germans come along and they say, no, Sundays you go out.
Yeah.
Right? And that's another part of their brand, is that, you know, a lot of the puritanical threads of the English settlement of much of the United States said, you can't do anything with alcohol on Sundays, heaven forbid. But the Germans said, no, that's a great day off work to drink beer.
Yeah.
So that's why the rest of Iowa, I mean, I think the German community in Iowa has a real bright spot around Scott County. They even called it the State of Scott. I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but they would pass, you know, the state would pass a law that was very puritanical. Absolutely no alcohol on Sundays. But the Germans were going to go out to Schützen Park and you know, fire guns and drink beer. So they can't have that. So Scott County kind of developed its own wink and nod towards some of the more puritanical elements. I mean, even as late as when I was growing up in Iowa, you could only buy liquor at state-run stores, and they were closed on Sundays, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, I think it was that German influence, is you can't take away beer.
That's got to be.
And then you mentioned the music. So in the Quad Cities, we owe a great debt of support, a debt of honor to the German immigrants. It was a German named Ludwig Becker who was the first director of the Tri-City Symphony Orchestra. And if you look at the initial roster, they did let a couple of Swedes sneak in. There was a guy named Hjalmar Frixell, and I think his spouse, too, played in the earliest ensembles, but most of the rest of the names are German. Hmm. And then they continued. Becker was a German immigrant himself, and you know, it's only later that you start seeing more anglicized names showing up in the roster. But yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Beiderbecke. His family, I think, was still speaking German in the home when he was born, right? And so we owe a great debt on these fronts of, physical fitness, music, and being outdoors. Oh, well, and beer drinking to our German. What are some other elements of the German immigrant brand that you find interesting?
The brand?
Yeah.
Well, the food is another one, right?
Not as big a draw as the Italians.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah, yeah.
No, but who doesn't like a good brat?
That's right. Yeah, that is true.
So definitely food. All right.
Yeah, food. And well, I'm still learning, so I might not. You've covered some of the important ones already, so.
Well,
we would go to Turner's in Moline when I was a kid. And in fact, I did gymnastics. That was like the first organized activity I did as a kid. And until I interviewed to go work at the German American Heritage Center, I had no idea that was a German organization and philosophy. And
yeah. Where was the Turner's in Moline? I'm blanking on this.
It's down, it's sort of by South Park. It's up in a hill. It's actually in a residential area.
Okay.
And I don't know the status of the building. I know the pool is not in good shape. In recent years, I think somebody had purchased it and they used the gym in it still. So, if you're familiar with South Park and Coal Town Road was what it used to be called, but there's a car wreck or some kind of mechanic there. It's up the hill from there actually in that area. I think I don't know the history of it. If they built the clubhouse for that neighborhood or how that all worked out. I just remember going there when we were kids and going to the pool and different activities there. So
Germans came with a lot of newspapers and
in the
early waves, the newspapers were in German and they kept the community together that way. But they also found the time, and I think, like you mentioned earlier, World War I was a bit of a catalyst for this, to do a little more rapid amelioration and becoming part of the broader culture.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's part of the story that the museum tells. I mean, because you don't see... in many communities, you're going to have celebrations around Mexican heritage, Irish, of course, we've got the St. Patrick Parade.
Right.
In many communities, there's a Columbus Day Parade for the Italian American community. You don't see as much of that, even in the strongly German communities like St. Louis and Milwaukee, Chicago, and Davenport.
Yeah, it's a different, some of it, I think, had to do with there were a lot of different German organizations in the Quad Cities, and so... we've kind of become the central source of German heritage, I think, because unfortunately some of those groups have dropped off or their memberships have been diminished. But we're happy to serve that role of German heritage specifically, but the immigrant story more generally, and then the community services that we do and the programming and we're open to everybody. We don't want people to feel like they can't come visit because they're not German or something. But we do programs. We do coffee and kuchen, and that's our second and fourth Sunday of the month. We do a lot of programming on the fourth floor. We have our gift shop too. Our gift shop is 95% import from Germany.
Is it really?
Yeah. So we do some local stuff as well. We have a partnership with Katie's Imports too. Mm-hmm. So we have some food from them. So people like that. We do our special events too. We have our Best of the Worst event that's coming up in July, and people enjoy that. Jerry's Market, and we thank WVIK for being a sponsor as well. And Zimmerman Honda's the presenting sponsor for that. But that's a good time. We do that in the parking lot. This will be my first year being part of this event, so I'm looking forward to that. I started last year. It was the week of Oktoberfest for the museum, so I was trial by fire and drinking from the fire hose for that week, but I was glad I got to see that event. We do that in September over at Kaiserslautern Square. And Chris Kindlemarkt is the other one that we do, our European market. Last year, well, the 2 years ago, there were... It was an ice storm, so that affected things a little bit. This year, the only 2 days that the temperatures were in the single digits were one of those days was our Chris Kindlemarkt day. But we had about 950 people that came out for that, so we had a really good attendance for it. So we have a tent set up outside for that event and some vendors and live German music, but we do some vendors inside for Chris Kindlemark too. So,
and where on the World Wide Web could I find out more about this?
That would be GAHC.org.
Couldn't be easier. No. German American Heritage Center, GAHC.org. Yeah. And a little bit more on the Best of the Wurst. That's Sunday, July 12th, noon to 4. There's a $5 entry fee, but kids under 12 get in free. And like you mentioned, featuring brats, beer, live music right there in downtown Davenport. That sounds like a great time. You mentioned Kaiserslautern Square. So yes. Kaiserslautern is a village in the northern part of Germany. Mm-hmm. Of all the places that Davenport would seek a sibling city relationship with, do you know why it was Kaiserslautern that was chosen?
I'm not sure why. I know I think it was, 20 years ago or so, where the city had a pretty strong connection in the Sister City Partnership, and there was a committee around that, and that's when they set up the plaza, and that's another thing I think kind of dropped off. I don't know really the history of it. I'd like to find out more about the people that were involved in that and maybe revive that a little bit too. But and that's where we do our Oktoberfest, is over at K-Square, so mm-hmm. we do that one over mm-hmm. there, but the other ones are at the museum. But yeah, so I don't know the whole history of that yet. But
well, and then I've come up with another one here right out of the blue. Not just the sort of the sister city stuff, but the other programs that you do that aren't events related. Mm-hmm. You made reference to those. What are some examples of those kinds of programs?
Well, the one that I like, we did it in partnership with the Violins of Hope, but we had the Mattis family, and they had done a program for the museum a few years ago, but the Mattis family was in the process of emigrating to the United States before World War II. And not all of the family came over at the same time. And so there was a lot of communication about what was happening in America and what was happening in Germany and the whole process of everybody coming here. And unfortunately, the parents of that group, or the grandparents, depending on what generation you're talking about, they did not make it here. They mm-hmm. they died in the concentration camp. Mm-hmm. And so we had a program in April that was about that, and two of the family members did the program. They're related somehow to the people that are in that story, and mm-hmm. so they had documents that they shared, and they did some music and a narrative and told the whole story, and it was a pretty remarkable story, and it was great that it tied in with the Violins of Hope. So, but it's, you know, we have one coming up about the Rhine, and so it's a variety of topics. It centers around coffee and cake and sure. Community. We had another one too in April. In Chicago is the Guter Institute, and we have a partnership with them. We work with them a little bit, but they were bringing a guest in from Germany, and he's a novelist and a DJ and a radio personality in Germany. And he was going to do some programs in Chicago, and Leonard, who's the contact in Chicago, had mentioned to Thomas, who was coming from Germany, that in the days in between his programs up there, they could reach out to some other partners and come and do a program. And so Leonard was giving him some different cities that he could come to, and he mentioned Davenport to come to the German American Heritage Center. And Thomas said, "I know Davenport because I've been a Bix Beiderbecke fan my entire life. I had a Bix Beiderbecke poster in my room as a teenager. I want to go to Davenport and do a presentation." So they came down, and he brought records from Germany with him, Bix Beiderbecke records, and talked about his passion for Bix Beiderbecke and jazz, and played some songs on a record player for us. So that was a good time too.
Playing the Davenport blues. Well, listen, I love a good story. We're going to come back to that Mattis family story in just a minute. But one of the things we celebrate here every week on The Conversation on WVIK is the storytelling prowess of Dr. Roald Tweet. It's time for this week's Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. For Rock Islanders, July 1915 is another date that should live in infamy. By the end of the Civil War, The Rock Island area had already become an important sawmilling operation. The trickle of logs coming down the Mississippi River from the great white pine forests of Wisconsin and Minnesota turned into a deluge as immigration to the Midwest and its farms swelled. The invention of the balloon frame house doubled and tripled the need for lumber. Like sand through an hourglass, the logs came down the river to 100 or more mills between Stillwater, Minnesota, and St. Louis, Missouri. The first logs floated loose to individual mills, but in 1871, the Rock Island lumber baron Frederick J. Weyerhaeuser organized 17 mills into the Mississippi River Logging Company to collect logs as they came from the tributaries into huge rafts and send them downriver. These log rafts were immense, as much as 300 feet wide and 1,500 feet long, 8 acres containing 10 million board feet of lumber, enough to build a small town. A crew of 20 to 30 lived and worked on each raft. By the 1880s, as many as 1,000 of these rafts a year floated past Rock Island. 40% of the white pine in Minnesota and Wisconsin ended up at sawmills in Davenport, Moline, and Rock Island. By 1900, it became evident that the end was near. The logs were nearly gone, thousands of acres gone while no one worried about the future. The last log climbed the chute to the Weyerhaeuser sawmill in Rock Island at 8 in the evening of November 18, 1905. Remember July 1915 as the date we used up our first inexhaustible natural resource. That month, the steamboat Otumwa Bell took the last raft of the last white pine down the Mississippi as people along the way turned out to watch an age disappear. An old raftsman, Charlie Russell, said it best. In the literature of waste, he wrote, this is our Iliad.
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And that's part of the reason we still get to celebrate Dr. Roll Tweet. The bigger part is that folks just like you become members of this public radio station and keep programs like this on the air. You can help out right now. Go over to wvik.org. You'll find a little button in the corner that says donate. Why not become a member of WVIK today? Make sure the programs like Roll Tweet's Rock Island Lines still have a place to call home. We also want to make sure that you find ways to support the German-American Heritage Center. Kirk Marski, its executive director, is here with me today. And we've been telling stories about some of the programming. You mentioned the programs with the Mattis family. So that's another element that we have to bring into the story. Within the Jewish community in the Quad Cities, you had, and it's dangerous to overgeneralize, but you had kind of two broad themes. More of the immigrants who came from more conservative communities in Europe, who are Jewish, tended to land in the Illinois Quad Cities. And there's a great stat that in 1901, I think there were 6 synagogues and shuls in Rock Island alone. Right?
Yeah.
And that all congealed into what was known as the Tri-City Jewish Center, which was mostly, that was a conservative congregation. But you see, these German communities of Jews became much more liberalized. And you go think back to Mendelssohn and his family, and Mendelssohn's grandfather was a great intellectual leader in Germany. And that was a different kind of a denomination known as Reform Judaism. And so that community, along with all of their German compatriots, tended to land more in Davenport. So you had up on Mississippi Boulevard, Temple Emmanuel, which was a Reformed Jewish congregation. And I mean, there were more before, but by the latter part of the 20th century, you kind of had those two centers of gravity in the Quad Cities, and now they've merged. And Temple or Congregation Beth Israel and Temple Emmanuel, they still work together, and they're still in Davenport. But I've always thought that was a fascinating part of the way that you have a kind of a religious social history combined with a national social sort of a history, and it kind of blends together through immigration into something that creates an even larger picture.
Yeah,
Davenport was enriched in many, many ways.
Yeah,
Yeah.
That's an interesting look at the history.
Well, and the Mattis family, I think was more affiliated with Temple Emanuel. It was just, you know, Germany was a, compared to countries to the east, it had gotten into public education a lot sooner. Mm-hmm. It was more liberal in terms of religious freedom and things like that. So you had that thriving Jewish community in Germany until the 30s. And when they came to the States, they brought many of those liberal ideas with them. And that's what created places like Temple Emanuel. But now, today, we have this wonderful center. And so it's great that you're doing these programs that lift up the Jewish aspects of German history in the Quad Cities. Do you have an idea of what exhibits you're looking at down the road?
We're in the early stages. We're talking with the Immigrant Coalition. We're working on one for, I think it would be in the spring. So we're still working on the early details of that. Claire does a lot of the heavy lifting on that. We're lucky to have her doing that work. So the current exhibit will run through November 1st. So the next one that we switch out would be early 2027, which sometimes seems like that's a long ways away, and sometimes I think it's already the middle or towards the end of May, and we're going to be there before we know it. So it goes quickly, for sure.
Two things are necessary for a successful not-for-profit, and one is mission. And mm-hmm. you've been talking a lot about that and the ways that the mission of the center is fleshed out day in and day out. The other element is margin. You have to make a little more revenue than you are spending.
Yes.
And so to get into not-for-profit leadership, was that much of a learning curve for you? You mentioned being with JA earlier, but I mean, being responsible for constantly, well, and my hero in terms of not-for-profit management was Don Wooten, and he had a very simple philosophy.
Yeah.
It could be summed in three words. It's never enough.
Right.
So what are some things that you do to ensure the fiscal viability of the German American Heritage Center?
So there is a learning curve, and I'm still learning, but I've learned a lot just in the 8 months that I've been there. I'm proud of the work that I've done to do it, and you know, people before me do it. Maybe they were doing it the same way. I'm not sure, but so I've worked for nonprofit organizations before, but I haven't managed a budget the same way or been the person responsible for leading the fundraising efforts and that type of thing. So it is a new thing. But the first thing I did was just dive into learn as much as I could about how we operate and what that means for the finances, the money coming in and the money going out. And I started tracking it in the way that I needed to learn more about, you know, the nuts and bolts of how it's all working. So we're in a much better spot as far as, for me personally, I mean, the organization is very stable, but it's just as far as me learning that process. It's I still feel like I have more work to do to kind of have it all figured out. But it's like you said, you have your programs, and some of those are funded already, and you have some that you want to do and they're not quite funded yet, or you want to start new things that need to be funded. So we are fortunate. We did get a grant from Regional Development Authority. So a long-term goal of our organization has been to hire a development director. So our director of development. And so thanks to some help from the Regional Development Authority, we have some funds to hire a director of development. So we'll be starting that process soon and have that job description out in the public where people can apply. But that'll be helpful to have somebody whose primary focus is identifying grants and different sources of funding. Some of them that we already partner on, but some new partnerships and some that maybe extend beyond the Quad Cities. And the Quad Cities is fortunate. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know about the number of nonprofit organizations that there are in the Quad Cities and the work that they do. And we're also equally fortunate for all the funding organizations, and that's the foundations and the corporations and everybody. And I think that's probably one of the best things about the whole Quad Cities is the way that the nonprofit community and then the people that support it, members and donors and the foundations and corporations, and it's a great part of the Quad Cities that we can address problems and create cultural experiences and the whole thing for the Quad Cities.
So. Sure. Now, there are some great examples of cultural centers like this. I think of the Czech and Slovak Museum that's in Cedar Rapids, which is a gem. If you have never been there, you should. Everyone listening should go check that out. There are lots of centers like this that I could think of in Chicago, St. Louis. What is the role of a center like the German American Heritage Center in terms of partnering with other corollary types of organizations that remember this kind of heritage stuff?
Yeah, we partner with, so some of those are local institutions. Some we mentioned already are the Figge Museum in Putnam and Botanical Center. We do some work with them. So some of those we do. But yeah, we extend out. And there's, I mentioned the Goethe Institute where they did a meeting in the fall last year. I went up to Chicago and they did a meeting with different German organizations doing different things throughout the whole country. So there was another organization from Peoria, but there were some from the Chicago area. There was Philadelphia, Portland, Oregon, Houston, Texas. And so we partner with those. And so those kinds of meetings are good too, because you can meet other people and see what they're doing. And they're not all doing the exact same thing, but you can learn from them. And sometimes people have the same successes and the same challenges. So you know, our partnerships extend out to that as well. So,
one of the things, Kirk, and I love to catch you right in on the spot here, but when I get to have interesting guests like you on the show, I like to ask things about what kinds of media are you consuming, and that could be books, that could be music, that could be podcasts, that could be movies. What have you been watching, reading, consuming lately?
So one is I've started collecting records again. My wife and I enjoy going to record stores, and so I unfortunately shortly after I left college, I was renting a house where the landlord but didn't bother to tell me that the basement would flood when it rained, so I lost all my records at that time. But the family got me some new record player a few years back, so that's one thing. But I also made a change with social media. I don't consume a lot with books or movies. I do from time to time, but on social media, I started doing something called bloom scrolling. And I don't know if you know what that is.
Tell me about that.
The opposite of doom scrolling, where you sort of be more selective about the things that you're following. And so I follow a lot of art pages. I follow, of course, German pages and that kind of thing. So things to the extent that I can that don't involve politics or news that I don't really find pleasant. So it's impossible to avoid all of those things. So, but that's something I've enjoyed doing. I started doing that a few months back to just have a more pleasant experience when I'm on social media of the things that I follow and look at. So
algorithms are amazing.
Yes.
And I like to follow all kinds of stuff. I'm just curious and I like to learn new things, but I must have spent too much time looking at these pages that would talk about tinned fish, you know, anchovies, sardines, oysters, mussels, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So now it's like as I'm rolling down, which I don't have too much time to do, but as I'm going, it's about every third item is about this guy sampling a different kind of tin fish that I will never see in my life,
because
it's probably from Iceland and something like that. But anyway, well, thank you for that. Any books you're reading?
I don't know if anybody would find it interesting. I mean, I'm a rock music fan.
Yes.
Most of the books I read have to do something with rock and roll, or more specifically the Van Halen family. Alex Van Halen wrote a book about his relationship with his brother, which actually was pretty interesting because it came out last October, right after I had started.
Yeah.
At the German American Heritage Center. And for people that don't know, the Van Halen family emigrated from Holland. And so they're...
Well, with Van, you would think that, right?
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're going to have to tell me more next time.
All right.
Because I hate to tell you this, Kirk. We've run out of time. Thanks to Kirk Marski from the German American Heritage Center. That's GAHC.org. And remember, friends, you can always catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK, Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and a rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8 right after Fresh Air. You can always find recent episodes at WVIK.org. Look for us under the podcast tab. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week on The Conversation on WVIK. Our guest will be Dino Milani from the Quad Cities Popular Astronomy Club. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Riley.
And WVIK is our NPR station.
You can depend on us for news in the Quad Cities at WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240DZ Dubuque. WVIK is your NPR station.